Welcome to The Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of The Social Podcast. I'm Melissa Grello, alongside a bevy of lovely ladies, including Cynthia Lois, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. Plus, we'd like to welcome back to the show scholar and writer Riley Yesno. Now, earlier this week, it was National Indigenous Peoples Day, and there's now a debate on whether it should be a statutory holiday. Riley, we're going to kick it off with you. Your thoughts, should this be a stat holiday?
So my basic thought is yes, mm-hmm. but I'm also just really sick of the way that like our conversations about what we need to do in regards to Indigenous people are always like statues and holidays and when should we lower the flag and when should we raise the flag? And like, it's all of these really symbolic gestures that like our symbolism is important, but on the day to day, that doesn't do anything to improve the lives of Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And there are dozens of reports with thousands of recommendations of actionable things we could be doing instead that always get pushed away for these debates about like, oh, should I get a day off work? How much education does that really do? All of these things. And I'm just like, it's the bare minimum, I think, you know?
Yeah.
Lois,
I initially was like, I'm not sure this should be a holiday because I think the people who most maybe need to learn and understand might avoid it and might take it as just another day off work and like go away to the cottage for the weekend. But as I say that, like I'm sort of conflicted because I can see that all over the city, there's all kinds of events happening. And I would love to have myself and my son be there and to be able to enjoy, experience, learn all of the things. And how can I do that? I'm here.
Yeah. Well, hey, Tammy on Facebook says, yes, one of those days at least should be a stat. Ceremonies should be broadcast nationwide and various movies and documentaries should be run on the major networks leading up to that day. Give it the same treatment as Remembrance Day so no one can ever say that they didn't know. And Tammy, that's a good point. But even Remembrance Day, it's not a national stat holiday in every province. Mm-hmm. And I would appreciate that. I love what you said about symbolism being... You know, it is important. Symbolism is important, but the actionable things that we could do rather than giving it a stat holiday. Sorry, I just wanted to applaud you for that. But I think everyone needs to be on the same page. Like, let's have a stat holiday, but make it nationwide rather than what they have right now for September 30th, National Indigenous Peoples Day, which is they're letting federal employees get it off.
Is this in Canada?
In Canada, yep. But they're letting each province decide who else gets it off. Mm-hmm. Just make it across the board.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the symbolism is important. I'm going to echo all of that. But I do also think there's a bigger question then is for settlers' descendants, like whose responsibility is it to then educate yourself and your family? And how do you choose to do that? You can't legislate that. You can't make someone say on a stat, you must sit down and talk to your family and your children. Like some people will... actively
but
opt
you sit
out
down on
barbecue.
Victoria Day and teach everyone about Queen Victoria?
That's not consequential the way that we are in a living, breathing time, that this is of consequence to lives today. And I've been grappling with this not only as a Canadian, but as a parent. And there is a stat holiday we all know of, which is Canada Day. It's certainly become fraught for some people over the last several years, I think necessarily so, because we are having a discussion of what does Canada Day mean? And a lot of people last year, for example, had said, I'm actually going to opt out this year. I've got a lot of thinking to do. And what does Canada becoming a country mean? And are we celebrating that when it simultaneously meant the full-blown oppression of Indigenous peoples? Like, are we celebrating oppression now? And I think some people were grappling with that. And other people were doing the opposite. Just digging in. Go Canada and all those. I don't know what's right and what's wrong. I just know as a parent, I'm trying to do better by me. And I'm certainly trying to do better by my daughter. And last July 1st, Canada Day, we decided to go to an Indigenous march in Toronto. And I thought that was going to be a more of a lesson for my daughter, learning about residential schools. This is from the Toronto Fire Council Cultural Center in the city. And there were tens of thousands of us there. And you know what made me the happiest? Wow. It was Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. Mostly non-Indigenous people. With who? Children.
Wow.
So if we knew that the day was really going to be spent learning and being allies and stepping aside and listening for once, I would vote for a statutory holiday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I really would.
And part of that learning is about how to talk about it, right? Like even the basics. And I mean basics as in, let's say, for example, Canada Day. You probably don't want to say Happy Canada Day to people who weren't settlers to this land, right? What that means. Happy Canada Day? What is happy about it? That is what? Commemorating what? You know, coming and taking over our land. So
even the way you talk about it and how you say happy or congratulations, or I think that even those basic conversations are being skipped, as you said, for the symbolism without understanding what's behind it. And I would like to explore how to even have that conversation. What do we say as settlers to an Indigenous person today? Happy Indigenous People's Day, but is it happy? I don't know if we should use the word happy, right? Is it a happy occasion to be marking this day that needs to be marked because of all this history? So I think even on the basic level, we're not even getting there. And maybe we should start with there. How do you say it? And the reason why I'm thinking about this is because it was just Juneteenth in the United States. They did declare it as a holiday. And I saw a video from a Black man, and he was like, well, something's weird. I went to the grocery store today, and a white person, so the colonizer, came up to me and said, happy Juneteenth. It's weird for me to be accepting a happy Juneteenth about my freedom when the ancestors of the people who was just talking to me are the people who took my freedom away. It's bizarre, right? So I don't think we're even having the basic conversations. And I would love to participate in those. Mm-hmm. Trial and error, you might get it wrong, but let's do it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, we're going to switch gears right now to a very different direction. Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt, they revealed in a joint interview with Goop that they still love each other 25 years after their split. Do any of you feel this way towards any of your former flames?
We will talk about exes in a second, but can we just talk about Brad and Gwyneth for a second?
Yes,
all day. We were talking about Brad and Jen ad nauseum last year. Like, are Brad and Jen going to get back together? And then all of a sudden, this. And I didn't think I'd have the reaction I did when I was reading it.
What was your reaction?
My reaction was like, oh my gosh, what if?
No,
she found her. You're right.
She says that in the article. I married a different Brad. My connection is with a different Brad. But it got me all nostalgic for those two. And I did think a little bit about the wording of, like, I still love you. And I'm sure, listen, love is different things to different people. I don't think they're talking to each other like they're going to hook up again. But I did start to think a little bit about my exes, because I think, yes, there's such a part of you, a shared history. There's a part of you that probably still part of you. Look at me. I'm talking outside of myself now. You see what I just did there? I think there is a part of me that still does love my exes, but do I think, obviously not in the same way as I did back then, but I think
and not in the same way you love Ryan.
Obvi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Look at Ryan. Ryan's like, yeah, thanks, Jess. Thanks for asking the question. Yeah, of course, it's not the same way, but I think there's always a part of you that will hopefully love your ex.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think that there's also, like, this idea that love either has to be this, like, really romantic thing, and, like, that's kind of it. And then other than that, once we break off from this romantic love, that it has to be this resentment or neutrality or, like, whatever, is a really toxic idea that we have about what relationships are supposed to be. And you can also, like, even if you don't want that person to be in your life anymore, you can love what they gave you at that time, what you learned about yourself, like things that you did together. That's, I think, a really healthy way to look at a period of your life and people in your life. And I also think about this, like, how different this is for, like, especially people like the queer community, which I'm a part of. Like, I think about my partner who has had one especially, like, long-term ex before we were together. And, like, they've gone out for, like, dinners and beers and all of these things together.
After the fact?
Oh, yeah, that I know about. Okay. And, like, part of it when we talk about it, right, is that it's like, you know, we were in St. John's, Newfoundland at the time and stuff like that. Like, the lesbian community, very small.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going to see this person. I'm going to be in community with this person for probably the whole time I'm here. And I'll always have roots. And why would I want to not have, like, something, you know, still beautiful in a relationship with this person that I'm going to see forever? And, like, I think that there's more to the relationship than just the interpersonal thing, too. There's the community aspect of it and the solidarity aspect for so many people. So that's important.
Beautifully said, but if you don't mind me asking and probing a little bit, did you get a little anxious about that relationship and the beautiful roots that they still have?
Yeah. I mean,
history.
I'll be honest. Yeah. It's like, there's that initial twinge that I think is like a, like, but when you investigate it, I think it really comes from a place of, like, insecurity and jealousy perhaps. And, like, this really, like, toxic narrative, I think, that it's like you kind of have to be possessive of a person.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I trust this person. I know everything. I'm so confident in this. And I was like, I love that they get to have this with other people and think that's a really beautiful thing. Aww, so
that's so healthy and mature.
That is.
That is. You know what? You said it. And Relly, you said it. You used the word healthy. Mel repeated the word healthy and mature. And I think that those are two beautiful words that don't apply to Hollywood. And we are talking about Hollywood people here. And so while I see on the surface that Gwyneth and Brad are like, oh, we still love each other after all this time, I mean, what they're doing is commercializing nostalgia for the gossip of their relationship to sell these cashmere sweaters that Brad just put out for like $2,000. Let me finish. Let me finish. But I will say, and doing it at a time when his other ex, for whom he shows no kindness, Angelina Jolie, he's using one ex to get back at another.
You think so?
Listen, days before this happened, I'll fill you in on the gossip, he leaked to newspapers that he was suing her. He was suing her for her share of the estate that they shared.
A winery,
where they got married and where their twins spent the first days of their lives.
But didn't she sell it without him?
She sold it with the approval of a court. What you're spewing, sorry, is his narrative.
We drank the Brad Pitt Kool-Aid.
Yes, what you're spewing is his narrative. He leaked it to the tabloids, got to you first on social media, then used an ex to get back at her. Let me post a tweet from a culture critic that I am obsessed with, Angelica Jade Bastien. Brad Pitt remains the most cunning with his star image. Interesting to see him interact with women from his past to shore up goodwill as things pop off with Angelina on a legal and personal basis. I'm telling you, a good-looking man can come and and give you a narrative about an ex, and you won't even see it that he's doing it to sharpen his knives in the back of another ex. That is not healthy or mature.
And selling a shirt that's almost $2,000.
There you go. And profiting from it.
But, this just got sin?
I can't. We're going to break, I think. I got lots to say. I don't see it that way, but that's a whole... Then we're switching and we're talking about a whole different story here. I'm going to end with Kathy on Facebook. So there's a difference between loving someone and being in love with someone. A lot of exes, especially those you have children with, still love each other. It's only a problem if they are in love with them. And I think that we don't know the tone. We didn't hear this. It's a written interview. So I feel like it was one of those things like, I love you. I do love you.
I love you all.
Yeah.
I like that.
No love for the woman he shares children with, though.
Ooh.
On that note, we're told to wrap it up.
Coming up next.
Hey, when traveling and experiencing different cultures, how do you draw the line between what is education and exploitation? Oh, that's a big one. That debate on the other side of this break.
You're listening to The Social Podcast. We're just getting started. Stick around. You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Download the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And make sure to catch The Social weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV.
And welcome back to The Social Podcast. Scholar and writer Riley Yesno is joining the conversation today. Plus, Jess Allen, Cynthia Loist, and Lainey Louie are along for the ride. Hey, Lainey. Take it away.
So a recent survey of North American and European tourists found there is a growing interest in indigenous-led tourism. The problem is, how do you draw the line between educational and exploitative experiences? What do you think, Riley?
I think that, first of all, I love this idea that indigenous communities are able to make money and to grow economies through things like tourism. Because I think so often indigenous people are really told, especially by people like the government and by industry, that like resource extraction is the only thing that they get their money from, right? And like going into these land claim deals and doing all of these things. And so indigenous buy and led ways is great. And there's nobody I trust more to actually do this in a good way and to take care of the land and like not, you know, ruin it in the process of doing this. The thing, though, that I worry about is that when I was reading up about this, I know people were saying that they want a culturally authentic experience. Mm. But that also relies on their assumptions of what is authentic in your eyes. Mm-hmm. Is it this, like, romanticized, exoticized version of who indigenous people are, these like spiritual of the earth people, is so much of, I think, the narratives that we have around indigenous people. And at what point are you not asking for education, but you're asking for a performance from these people? And that is like, can get into really icky territory.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. I guess for me, in line with what I was saying about raising my daughter, it's also about, to me, there is no equality without economic equality and sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the line of exploitative versus an authentic experience is who's running the show? I mean, is it an indigenous person led by the community? Is it supporting the community? And again, last year, I was seeking this out very, very much. And there's a beautiful community just outside of Quebec City called Wendake. Mm-hmm. It's the Huron-Wendat peoples. And they have this 5-star resort. It's called the Musée des Premières Nations. And you have an entire facility that is stunning. It is owned and run and supports the community. And so when I think authentic, I am a guest and they welcome you and I'm there to learn. And I also know that the food that I'm eating is being prepared by an Indigenous chef. I know that the cultural experiences that we're doing in the Longhouse, for example, the teacher who's sitting there around the fire is a person of the community. So for me, it takes a little bit of extra work if you want to do the right thing. But is it worth it? I want my money to speak and support the people who I want to support, not the Disneyfied version of what an Indigenous cultural experience looks like. And I want the money to go where I want it to go, which is in the community. So yes, do the work. Just do a little bit of research.
I mean, that looks incredible, but I don't think that's going to be accessible for lots of people. I'm going to guess that was several hundred dollars at least per person per night, which is amazing if you can do that. But
people are spending that anyway, Cynthia.
I don't know.
They're spending it anyway.
I don't know. I think a lot of people are struggling right now financially.
No, you're right. But I think what I'm saying is people who want to travel and want to do sustainable educational travel, you know, people are struggling. And by the way, there's a ton of stuff even just here in Ontario. You can spend $60 and have a fully Indigenous-led experience. Like, you don't have to break the bank. But if you want to support the community, you've got a little bit of extra money, you want to do something with the family, we're not talking a trip to Europe. It's not as expensive as you might think. For me, if there's people like me who are like, we want to do right, that's all I'm saying.
I keep thinking about the states and how I think it was a couple of days ago that the federal government announced that they will co-manage Bears Ears National Park, which is 1.3 million acres, a place I've always wanted to go. And they're going to co-run it now with the original inhabitants, 5 Indigenous tribes who've lived there much longer than it has been a park. And I just thought that was such a beautiful idea. One of the spokespeople said, this just makes so much sense. The person much smarter than I am said, today, instead of being removed from a landscape to make way for a public park, we are being invited back to our ancestral homelands to help repair them. And National Parks Canada, they do have Indigenous partners. I saw on the website there's 4 sort of tours that you can take in the lesser known parks. But that just immediately, our Canada parks bring in so much money, mm-hmm. so much tourism. What a perfect natural way to get people to make money for Indigenous people, because there's a lot of money to be made, but also to educate. Maybe I'm being nostalgic and overly emotional about the Canadian landscape, but there's just something that it just seems to make sense.
Yeah, I love that idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't been able to think about travel much. I still have so much post-COVID anxiety. And but the last trip I took, and I'm curious to know your thoughts about this. I went to Calgary, and it was my friend Jan Arden. It was her birthday, and all she wanted to do was to go to a casino. So we went to, and I'm going to get the Grey Eagle Resort and Casino, and it's Indigenous owned and run. And obviously, this is one of those things where, I don't think this, when we're talking about going and learning, I don't think this is anything to learn. This is not, but is this still, yeah. is this still a good gesture? Like, is this, like, I'm struggling with asking this in a way that isn't crass.
No, I think that's good. And good to distinct that it's like, yeah, going to the Indigenous casino is not, you know,
a cultural
expanding
experience.
Your cultural yes. yeah, knowledge of Indigenous people. But what it is doing is like what we were talking about of taking money that you would spend in other places and putting it instead into the hands of Indigenous communities, Indigenous people. And like people ask me all the time, like if that's the appropriate thing to do for even things like earrings. Like they're like,
yeah.
can I buy beaded earrings and doing whatever? I'm like, yes, in fact, like Indigenous creators want and need you to be able to make a livelihood. And so like it's as long as you're not profiting off of this experience, as long as like you don't take it and try and then sell like, oh yeah, I had this great cultural experience. Let me tell you all about it at the casino. Like, you know, yeah. I just think that that's actually a really like actionable thing to be doing. It's way, you know, actually, you know, maybe makes a bigger difference in some ways than just reading a book about Indigenous people, but actually putting money into their hands.
Can I add a wrinkle to that though? Because I am a casino lover and I'll do a casino wherever, but you know, being from BC, we do also have a lot of casinos there. And the thing is that I do think that there are layers, like as Mel said, you know, the experience should evolve. So I 100% support that the fact that on these casinos, the money goes back to the communities. And yet the casino experience in and of itself is excess. There's buffet at casinos. There is waste produced at casinos. So when we're thinking more and more now about cultural experiences that benefit communities and how to do it sustainably, there will be trips that you only tick one box, but you may not be able to tick both, but both should, especially as we're beginning to understand the Indigenous experience, is to respect the land, not to be wasteful of the land. So it's a little bit like, you know, I did think about my casino experiences after our meeting today, and then I wondered, but at the casino, I'm seeing people, even at the Indigenous casino, fill up their plates five times, like at the buffet. Like, a casino comes with a buffet.
But I guess don't let perfectionism get in the way of progress. Yeah. There's nothing that's going to be perfect.
Yeah.
I don't think. I think if you're trying and your head's in the right space. And also, like, what do you get out of it? Like, what do you get out of it? Is it that you just want to be sit there and, like, be entertained? You know, and maybe entertainment's a small part of it, but are you feeling educated? Are you walking away, hopefully, wiser and smarter and to do your life differently? I don't know. I'm of course, I struggle with that because there's always that play between making money and learning
and having a vacation.
And having a vacation. And like, there's a lot, but at the same time, like you said, I don't want my perfectionism about how to be the perfect ally to get in the way of actually getting off my butt and doing something, just something.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's like a really excellent point to your bringing up about a conversation in Indigenous communities is just because we want, you know, economic sovereignty for people and we want Indigenous people to be able to sustain themselves through their own businesses, their own economies, doesn't mean we're also exempt from, you know, the impact that running businesses can have. So things like, so there are people who talk about Indigenous people should be able to do with their land what they want, including resource development, if that's the case. Sure. Yes, absolutely. But then that also still contributes to climate change where Indigenous people in other parts of the world are going to suffer because of those decisions. So it doesn't exempt you from that just because it's also part of this conversation. So I think you're right that there is like wrinkles and imperfections and balances that we do have to pay attention to in all of it.
Yeah. Keep that food for thought as you're planning maybe some summer road trips or whatnot. Yeah. Riley, what an absolute pleasure to have you with us today and joining this conversation. Thanks for being here in person, finally in person.
Thanks for having me. It was lovely.
Still to come on The Social Podcast, is it comedy's job to offend? Plus, Elvis is in the building. Baz Luhrmann and Austin Butler are here to discuss their epic new film about the king of rock and roll. Next week on The Social, we're getting ready to kick off summer with finger foods for Canada Day. Plus, how to style your bathing suit beyond the beach. The Social, weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV.
Welcome back to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. I'm Melissa Grello, along with Cynthia Loyce, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. And joining us now, we are welcoming stand-up comedian Vong Cho. Cynthia, take it away.
Okay, comedy is what we are debating next. In an interview with the Irish Times, British comedian Rowan Atkinson said, it's comedy's job to offend, and that cancel culture shouldn't drain it of its potential. Vong, I can't wait to hear your thoughts about this.
I think, honestly, I don't think cancel culture has been going too far in comedy. I think the only thing going too far in comedy is complaining about cancel culture. I can't take this. Every time I open up Netflix or HBO, I'm just seeing another straight white guy for 60 minutes talk about how hard it is to be a comedian and how they can't say what they want to say.
On their Netflix show.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And so for me, it's like, you know, I feel like if you're so afraid of being canceled, just quit. Like, just quit because you know, stand-up comedy, it takes a certain amount of bravery. And everything I say on stage, it's in joke form, but I believe in it. So if you're offended by what I say on stage, you'll be offended with me in real life, too. And for me, the only two things that I think about of whether I'll say something is, do I stand behind it enough that I'll defend it if somebody gets upset with me? If it's yes, then I'll do it. The other thing, too, is I think, would I say that in front of the people that I'm making fun of? Because I started out in Alberta in my comedy career. I was like the only Asian comedian, the only gay comedian in a lineup for like 10 years.
Wow.
And I remember my very first comedy special in Alberta was called I Hate White People.
In Alberta. Wow.
But it was in front of an audience of all white people because I wanted to challenge their views because in Alberta, it's really common to say there's no such thing as racism.
Yeah.
We've moved past it. We're post-racial. So I was like, oh, no, I'll show you racism. And then they'd call me a racial slur. And then I'd be like, now we can talk. Now we can keep it real.
Wow.
Let's not pretend. But because it was in front of all white people, I felt like I could call it I Hate White People. But if it was like, you know, it's like if somebody's making fun of like Chinese people in front of all white people, then maybe it's different. It's like, are you daring enough to say it in front of those people? And like I said, if you don't have that bravery, if you're too worried of getting canceled, just quit.
Yeah.
Just quit. I'm tired.
But is it also...
I love that.
Is it also the idea of punching up versus punching down? In other words, you know, we punching down people, I think universally agree that that's a no-go zone. If you're punching down to somebody who... when you bring in intersectionality, is that a difference?
I think, you know, I have a somewhat differing view of this from, like, a lot of my friends. A lot of my friends work in human rights. But for me, because I grew up in Manitoba, in Winnipeg, murder capital Canada, very rough neighborhood. And, like, you know, like, in our culture, it's like, you know, trash talking or making fun of each other was actually a way to uplift each other. It's sort of like a challenge. So it's like, if we didn't like somebody, we would ignore them. But if we're like trash talking or making fun of, it's actually an invitation. It's actually saying you're my equal, and I think you can rise to the challenge.
Oh, interesting.
And so, you know, I guess for me, the idea of punching down never came to my mind because why would you challenge somebody who you didn't think could fight back?
That's
like to me, I wouldn't even think.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah.
I think that's a really. I mean, I think that's an interesting perspective given the generation of comic that you come from. I mean, a lot of the ones complaining about cancel culture are the generation that came before you. And I say this because one of the most exciting comics working today is Jared Carmichael. Mm-hmm. His special, which is on Crave, Rathaniel, just came out. And he came out in the special about 3 months ago. And so he, as a black young comic, obviously looks up to somebody like Dave Chappelle, who would have shaped his career. So when asked recently what Jared thinks of Dave Chappelle, his answer was amazing, and it kind of changed my perspective on how to view the Dave Chappelle thing. And Jared said, well, I mean, if that's the hill he wants to go out on, I'm gay. My comedy is relating to a young generation of people who are offended by Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle now, as Jared said, if you Google him, is known for one thing, stomping on trans people. And that lives forever. He's a guy who did the racial draft. He's a guy who did so many great jokes. But the only thing that people bring up right now in relation to Dave Chappelle, this comic with such a great library of jokes, is, oh, that guy who attacked trans people. That's on Google. That's a generation. And so Jared Carmichael was like, okay, that's the legacy you want to leave, you do you. And that to me was so brilliant.
It's a great way to look at it, but the trouble with that, as I have read, is Dave Chappelle holds so much power and sway. And the idea of punching down that he's been accused of is that his words carry a consequence, not for him, for trans people. The attitude that someone might carry running into a trans person, if you are a huge fan of Dave Chappelle's, is that there are real life consequences for the jokes he makes.
And he has to wear that.
Well, he has to wear that, but people are getting beaten and die. I mean, this is what I'm saying.
That's part of his legacy.
You know?
If people die because of your jokes, that's what shows up on Google in 50 years, in 75 years. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. Mm-hmm.
But his peers, I feel like Dave Chappelle hasn't, like, going back to what you said, people were going about saying that there's a problem in comedy about being canceled. I can't think of a comedian that has actually been canceled. There have been consequences, but Dave Chappelle just introduced Jon Stewart on stage at the Mark Twain Comedy Awards in front of his peers to massive applause. So there is not, like, consequences.
Louis C.K. Sure. just won a Grammy.
Oh, my God. Let's move on from that. Well, this next topic might also offend a woman. Get this. On TikTok, that's what I said, has left people divided after slamming her boyfriend for wearing socks on the beach. Is this a fashion crime or a good way to protect your footsies from the sun? Go!
I would leave this person immediately.
What?
Well, listen, I'm being a bit dramatic, but like the first thing I do when I get home is take off my socks. I have hot, feet that run hot and still have me. They're sweaty, they're hot under there. I want my socks off immediately and for comfort. I try to take Jaya's socks off immediately. So the idea of going to a beach and having sex with a person who goes to the beach with socks on is, to me, I can't abide it. I can't.
He's hot, though.
I mean, he was very hot.
Was
I wasn't
so
looking at his feet.
Exactly. I was like, oh, God. Okay.
Hi.
We're like, so good looking.
To a shot. Socks on the beach.
So true.
I think the reality is that sand gets very hot. Flip-flops and sandals, let's be honest, barely do the job. And then your feet get all, if they are sweaty, they're going to get, you know, the sand. I love the beach. I hate sand.
What? Yeah.
Sand is annoying. Ugh. It gets everywhere.
It's just, we need to get your hot take on this phone.
I am 100% on the side of socks.
Yes. Really? 100%. Yes. Okay.
On the beach.
This on side. The beach. Okay, so I grew up playing beach volleyball. And you wear performance-enhancing socks on the beach. It actually helps you play volleyball. And I, you know,
what do they do? Performance-enhancing
like
socks.
Like support.
Never heard of. I'm
no. Protection.
Yeah, protection.
Oh,
and
the
also, elements. You know, it. You know, a good analogy is they're kind of wearing performance-enhancing socks on the beach is like wearing flippers in water or wearing snowshoes when you're walking. Like, it actually helps you jump higher.
For her pleasure.
Higher.
That's what I thought it was.
Wow.
It's a racial divide.
This is dividing people.
Yeah.
You have, tonight, you are hosting a queer comedy show. It's entitled Fruit. And you are celebrating Pride. This is a massive all-star lineup as well. Can you tell us a little bit about your show?
Well, first of all, it's just nice to be celebrating Pride live for the first time in 3 years. And the lineup tonight, I'm so, so happy with it. We've got Ted Morris and Martha Chavez, who honestly, when I was growing up as a comedian, they were my mentors. And then when I got into the industry, they then mentored me like in person instead of just seeing them on TV. And then to close out the show, we have Robert Watson, who is a Canadian Comedy Award winner, and he's recording his first ever comedy album, so really excited.
Wow.
That's great.
That's fantastic. We want to tell everybody who's watching, if you are in the Toronto area, you can get tickets to tonight at the Rivoli. Tickets available at the door. Vong, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride indeed.
Still to come on The Social Podcast, what did Priscilla Presley really think of Baz Luhrmann's new film, Elvis? And how did Austin Butler prepare for the iconic role? Don't miss it.
You're listening to The Social Podcast. Find us on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite shows. And join the conversation online at The Social CTV.
Hey, welcome back to The Social Podcast. You've got Cynthia Loist and me, Melissa Grello. And today you're in for a very special treat. Take a listen.
Our country itself is sick. But it's lost its sense of direction. Even its common decency.
You don't so much as wiggle a finger.
There's a lot of people saying a lot of things. But in the end, you gotta listen to yourself.
Oh my gosh, screaming inside. Welcome back. Elvis is in the building, and there are only a few figures in entertainment history that are as iconic as Elvis Presley. And in a new film by Baz Luhrmann and, of course, his life and story are all coming back to life.
So we are obviously thrilled to have the director and star of the highly anticipated movie Elvis, Baz Luhrmann, Austin Butler. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. And in Toronto.
And in Toronto.
I've lived here before.
I think it's a great omen to start here. I would just like to say, listen, we saw the film.
Yeah.
Cynthia and I were like grabbing each other at multiple times through the film.
Yes.
What a beautiful, emotional, raw journey through Elvis's life.
Thank you.
I've got to ask, why Elvis, Baz? Like, why Elvis's story, yeah. And why now, and why tell it?
Yeah, well, actually, we were chatting together on the way in, and you guys said you saw the movie, you felt you'd been at a rock show, but yeah. You also were talking about it at dinner. Mm-hmm. And some beautiful things that Cynthia, you said is that, you know, you learned so much about Elvis you didn't know, particularly about giving credit where credit is due and the fact that he grew up, his association with so many iconic black musicians coming up with him together, but also the relevance of what was going on in that time to now. Mm-hmm. I think for all those reasons, I wanted to do it. Plus, you know, he's kind of cool and sings well.
Just a little bit. Austin, I mean, you are just incredible in this role. It is. I didn't know a lot about Elvis going into this, but I sort of fell into this trance. And you, I mean, I would not have known that you were you. I kept on losing myself just seeing Elvis Presley. So what did it take for you to get into this role?
It was a lot. I mean, we had 2 years where I didn't do anything else. And I always try to abridge this part of it, and then I have things afterwards where I'm like, oh yeah, and I did that. I had a karate instructor and many singing coaches and dialect coaches and my incredible movement coach, Polly Bennett. And with Polly, I mean, we did everything from tap dancing, swing dancing, studied all the influences that Elvis had, so watching Little Richard and studying his movements. And Baz and I went down to a gospel church and got to experience what it feels like when you're moved by the spirit of spiritual music in that way. Mm. And that was really informative because Elvis never had choreography. It was about the music moving him. Mm. So for me, I then always knew that if I wasn't feeling the feeling I felt in that church, then I wasn't feeling it, then I was off, you know? So yeah, it was a year and a half before I started shooting. I'm just experimenting with everything, and you know, yeah. So that's a little bit of it.
I mean, music is the center of this film in so many ways, and Baz, in fact, many of your films, it's the music that grounds and brings that story to life. And you have woven Elvis's music with contemporary music, like some remixes, a new song with like Doja Cat, for example, which is that so video hot.
Love Doja Shonka from our movie. In a gospel church in Nashville.
We
discovered.
She's incredible.
She's incredible in this film. So, okay, the idea of how does this use of music in this way, how do you see that as a storyteller and director? Is it the music first and then the film follows, or is it the film and then you plug in the music?
It's equal in the script. Like, to me, you have words, but you also have music, and I treat them with equal weight. As I do the visual language, one thing about this, I mean, you get... Make no bones about it. You get early Elvis rock and roll sung by that man there. Right? He sings it. I had to put a video out to prove it. People didn't believe it, including in one screening, Lisa Marie Presley. and then you hear real Elvis, just some, you know, when you see that voice at the end and you know he's going to pass soon, that's real Elvis. But to translate some of it, to open the door to what it felt like. I did what I did with Jay-Z on Gatsby, and I brought all these guest artists in, and as you say, there's everyone in there from Doja Cat to Stevie Nicks, Tame Impala, you know, Jack White does a duet, Eminem's got a piece, you know, Maneskin. It's a long list. I mean, Jasmine Sullivan. If I keep doing the list,
so great. Austin, you play Elvis throughout many different decades. And, you know, from when he's just starting out and he's a nervous sort of kid, right to the end. Was there an era that was most challenging to sort of get into?
I try to think about that. They each had their own challenges because we were filming out of sequence. I remember when we very first met, there was this, we had this romantic idea that we could somehow film it in chronological order. And I thought, well, okay, so then maybe I'll be able to take a break and gain the weight. And that's kind of how I imagined that we would be able to do it. And then with the COVID of it all and scheduling everything, it was, so we would be switching back and forth. So some days I'm in 72, the next I'm in 56.
Wow.
And it's the challenge of having to ground yourself in where he is emotionally, spiritually, physically, vocally at every one of those periods. So there's not just one. I mean, there's certain moments that were more challenging maybe than others, but it's kind of how it all fit together.
Mm. That is amazing. I didn't realize that you shot like that. Okay, so Baz, Cannes Film Festival, let's go back there for a second. The movie is shown, gets a 12-minute standing ovation.
That's
like,
good.
Tough crowd. Great standing ovation.
They boo in Cannes. I was there when I was 29. I've opened it twice. They don't like your movie. You hear, woo. and so we heard,
A 12-minute, including Priscilla Presley, who tweeted, obviously, so many other things. And she said, not an empty seat in the theater. Austin Butler's performance as Elvis was mesmerizing. I mean, listen. I mean, getting the approval from the audiences and all of that is one thing. Mm. Getting Priscilla's stamp of approval?
It was everything. Yeah. It was everything because it wasn't. Oh, gosh, there we are. you can see how emotional we are. We're not kidding here. Like, the relief. Like, by the way, during the film, at the musical numbers, from Little Richard on, they started applauding to the musical numbers like they were at a rock show.
Yeah.
That was an emotional experience. But I've opened Cannes twice, but all that, yeah, sure. But I've never been more nervous because Priscilla and Lisa Marie and Roddy, they don't control the estate. They didn't dictate what I should do. I met them early on. COVID kept us estranged. I didn't know what they'd think. And no screening made me more nervous, anxious, and worried than when I had to show them the film. I mean, to the world, maybe he's an icon. To some younger people, maybe he's a Halloween costume.
Right.
But to them, he's a husband and a father and a grandfather, a person. And the humanity of Elvis, just meeting the person, that's what Austin was tasked with. So we were so nervous about it.
Mm-hmm. Baz, as we were talking just before we went to air, race is really at the center of this film.
Sure, because it's the center of America.
Exactly. But it was just so interesting to see how many parallels there were to today.
Yep.
What commentary were you trying to convey as it relates to like Elvis's story?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not so much a commentary, but actually you can't tell his story without engaging with his relationship with black music, his relationship growing up in that one of the few white houses during segregation. That scene where he's in the gospel tent and his little friend, he's in a little group of African-American kids, and the preacher reaches out and grabs him. I met that man. I found him and I videoed him and he told me that story verbatim. You take that out of Elvis's story, I don't think you're telling Elvis's story, and you're not telling the story of America. Mm. So it's important that we show the lineage, the DNA, give credit where credit is due, which is what Austin obviously says. So I stole that line from him. But he says, you know, we got to give credit where credit is due. We've got to show the true story.
Mm. Austin, as Baz has mentioned, you sung for real when you were playing young Elvis, but you'd never before professionally sang. So talk about the vocal training. Like, you have still so much of him in your voice, too. So talk about that experience and what you had to do to make that happen.
Well, it began by listening to his entire catalog. And so in the same way as you listen to every interview he ever gave, there's a whole catalog of all of his interviews, but then you listen to the way that he used his voice while singing, and it changes a lot over the years. And so I wanted to prepare, just in case, I wanted to prepare to be able to sing it all. Though I knew that from the get-go, Baz told me very early on, well, the 50s was recorded on acetate. It's mono, we can't use it. So it's gonna have to be your voice. So that I felt, that would wake me up in the morning at 3 a.m. And I would have a certain song that I knew I needed to work on, and I would listen to 3 seconds of it and just hear how he hit a certain note and just practice it a million times and record myself, listen back and figure out what sounds different. And then you sort of just piece that together for the whole thing. And so it was a lot of obsession.
No kidding. You've got icons all around you. You have Baz Luhrmann sitting there.
Yeah, I mean, he's an icon.
Right?
Yeah.
I love that. No, from really old.
No.
Icons have to be really old.
No, that's not. Although my father doesn't.
He's a very young, dashing icon.
Exactly.
Look at him. Very deaf. Say that again.
Yes. but also, let's not forget Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Playing Tom Parker in the film. What does a Tom Hanks tell you on set to give you advice? Or did he even give you any guidance in this iconic role?
He did give me advice, but I mean, I think back to the first time that I met him. I was telling this story the other day, how it's the thing of meeting your heroes, where you don't know if you're going to be able to get past the fact that this is Tom Hanks. I feel like he's a part of my family because the amount of times he's been on my TV as a kid and all throughout my life. I mean, he's one of the greatest actors of all time. And so the very first time I met him was in Baz's backyard, and he gives me this giant hug. And then he quickly broke down any of those barriers, and he said, you know, I was at the studio earlier and I was trying to choose which door I was going to throw up outside of the first week. And I said, why, are you scared? And he goes, yeah. I go, you're scared. I'm terrified. And then from that moment, then I thought, oh, Tom Hanks feels fear. You know, Tom Hanks cares in that same way. And so then we were colleagues. And then we did things like when he first arrived, he very generously gave me a typewriter. And with this typewriter came this letter that he had written from Colonel Tom Parker. And he says, on this machine, we can now communicate. And so I typed him back a letter as Elvis. And it became this way I've never rehearsed before, which is putting the mind of a human being onto the page and then sending it. And so then we sent these letters back and forth. I have a whole stack of them now. And that was an amazing way to sort of build backstory and richness. And then we also, we just had the best time. It was incredible.
Unbelievable. Listen, I know you're about to just set this film loose around the world to be able to spend a few minutes with us. We really want to thank both of you for making us stop here.
You've created something really, really magical.
Really, really is.
Thanks so much. Really, it means a lot.
Thank you both. Really. All right, so this is where we tell everybody that Elvis has opened in theaters this weekend. Get your tickets now. You do not want to miss this film. It is going to change you. That's it for this edition of The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Hey, we hope you had as much fun as we did. The conversation continues on The Social. That's weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV. Join us.
Don't miss a fiery debate. Subscribe to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite shows. Until next time, socialites.